So we're still in the first chapter on the Kadika, verse 27. Padram karne vishnu yamane vaha Padram pashe maksha bhirya chatraha Stirai rangai islushtu vagum sastanubihi Yashema devahitam yatayuhu Swastina indro vrittashravaha Swastina pusha vishvavedaha Swastinastarksho arishtanemihi Swastino brahaspatir tathatu Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Verse
27.
Is that with Savasya?
Sarvasya pranavo hyadihi Sarvasya pranavo hyadihi Madhyamantastatayavacha Evam hi pranavam nyatva Evam hi pranavam nyatva Vyashnute taranantaram Vyashnute taranantaram Sarvasya pranavaha hi adihi madhyam antaha tatha evacha evam hi pranavam nyatva vyashnute tat anantaram. Remember, pranavaha is the name for the omkara, for om. So saying om, you say pranava, more respectful. So the pranava is the adihi, he just means indeed. Indeed, the pranava is the adihi, is the beginning, the medium, the middle, and antaha cha, and tatha eva cha, and similarly the end, okay? Tatha eva cha. So, the, of what? Of everything. Sarvasya, of everything. The pranava, the omkara, the sacred syllable om, indeed is the beginning, the adi, the medium, the middle, and similarly, the antaha, the end of everything. Evam hi pranavam nyatva, having known the pranava, the om, in this way, evam, indeed, evam hi, indeed, having known the omkara, the sacred syllable om, the pranava, in this manner, vyashnute tad anantaram, One gains pratnoti, vyashnute means pratnoti, one gains that anantaram, immediately. Anantaram means without any in-between. The idea of anantaram is kind of, you can use an example, because it's not like you gain knowledge of om, of the meaning of om. And then, having gained the knowledge, then you become that, right? It's like saying, when you turn on the light, once you turn on the light, then the darkness goes away. Turn on the light, and then darkness goes away. Well, actually, when you turn on the light, the darkness is gone. So this anantaram means there's no space, right, between the knowledge and the becoming. So there's many verses in the Upanishads like that. Knowing Brahman, one becomes Brahman. Knowing the self, one becomes the self. But you can mistake that, meaning having known the self, then you become the self. But knowing the self, you become the self because you already are the self. Right? So the problem is one of ignorance. It's not one of becoming. What caused you to take yourself not to be that is ajnana, is ignorance. And so when the ignorance is removed, you recognize that it's not that you've become that. You recognize that you have always been that and always will be that. See what I mean? So that's the idea of this anantaram. So here on they say, remember the Om, when we say the sacred syllable Om, it's what we call the Abhidhana of the Abhideya. The Abhidhana means the name. So Om is the name for actually Ishwara. Om is the name for Ishwara. And so the Abhideya is what the name names. Right? And so that's a kind of, that's a continual theme throughout the Mandukya Upanishad, is understanding this relationship. It's important to understand this relationship because here the Upanishad is giving knowledge of this nama, of this nama, of this name, Om, and gaining the knowledge of Om, the Abhideya, what the Om is a name for, we gain knowledge of the nature of reality, as opposed to using Om for just upasana, where we know it's a sacred syllable and we meditate on the symbol itself. You can meditate even on the symbol, you can meditate on the sound of the symbol, or you can gain knowledge of that symbol as the nama for whatever it is naming. And when that is the case, there is no real duality at all between the name and its object. It's like if I say to you the word chair, the word evokes the object, chair. If I say rug, it evokes the chair, it evokes the rug. And so this is the relationship, the very interesting relationship between the nama, the Abhidhana and the Abhideya, that the name actually, its sole purpose, you know, is to reveal the object in a sense. And so in the Mandukya Upanishad, this, the whole Upanishad has been an analysis and an unfoldment of this syllable Om. And as you understand the syllable, this Om, you understand, you gain knowledge of the Abhideya, that which it's a name of, right? And so here, now we're on the Katika, which is near the end of the first chapter of the Upanishad. So we've already done all 12 verses, and these last few verses are wrapping up kind of the total vision of the Upanishad. And so, and then in the next three chapters, it's again just going to go into a deep analysis of what's been revealed by the Upanishad. Mm-hmm. But as it is now, all of the verses that we're looking at, the Katika verses, are very tied to the verses in the Upanishad. Mm-hmm. And so since we just finished the Upanishad verse 12, we've had 24, 25, 26, and now 27, and two more to go, that are really centered on this final verse of the Upanishad. Right? And so it's just sitting, the Katika is just sitting on that verse and expounding upon it, where Gaudapada is kind of expounding upon it in his own way. It's like taking what the Upanishad is saying, and then you say it in a way that expands it, but you're expanding it in your own way. It's not going line by line or word by word from the Upanishad. That's what makes it a Katika, as opposed to a Bhashya. A Bhashya takes each word of the Upanishad verse and defines it, defines the sentences, puts the whole verse into, expands the meaning of the verse, and then gives what we call Purvapaksha Siddhanta, kind of objection and answer to any other ways of interpreting that verse. That's a Bhashya. But a Katika is when Gaudapada, who's the writer of this one, is kind of saying the Upanishad again in his own way, like that. But it's very focused on the Upanishad, and so that's why when we're studying the Mandukya, you study the Mandukya Upanishad along with the Katika, and Shankara wrote his Bhashya not just on the Upanishad. In fact, he did very little with the writing the Bhashya on the Upanishad verses. He's mostly writing his Bhashya, his commentary, on the Katika verses, which are expanding the Upanishad. The reason they say he's doing that is because Gaudapada is Shankara's teacher's teacher. And so out of respect for Gaudapada, he lets Gaudapada unfold the 12 verses of the Upanishad, you know, and then from there he takes it with his commentary. So that's just a kind of a traditional type of respect. Anyway, so here this what this verse is saying, Sarvasya Pranavaha, this Om, the Om, is the beginning, middle, and end of everything. So then how could Om be the beginning, middle, and end of everything? And then having known Om, one gains that. It's because the Om, the Omkara now, is the name for Brahman, for the Atma, which is Brahman, which is the self of the waking state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state, or in this sense, the sthiti, what we call the let me see what words he's using, the srishti, the creation, the beginning, the creation, the sthiti, the sustenance, and the laya, the dissolution of everything, the entire creation. So this whole creation means absolutely everything that exists within duality. Everything that exists within duality, that exists within time and space, on every dimension. When I say every dimension, that means this waking state counts for the dimension that we experience through our sense perception. That's what we mean by waking state. It's whatever can be experienced through your sense perception. Dream state is all of those states of experience, dream being an example and the kind of the purest form, but every state of experience that does not require sense perception, like for instance your imagination, emotions, flights of fancy, daydreams, the dream state in and of itself, and even the dream state in this waking state, you're having as though dream states all of the time, and you're kind of lost in your mind, you're lost in your thoughts. That's the taijasa, that's the dream state, right? And they're because what they're talking about is that state of mind where there is much going on, but whatever is going on, it's not being generated at the moment by your sense perception. So that's the dream state. You're the self of the waking state, right? You're the self of that dream state. And then the third is the deep sleep state. Deep sleep state means where neither the mind is active. The mind is in what we call the avyakta, the unmanifest condition. The sense organs are also withdrawn, so in the deep sleep state, we don't have the experience of the waking state. We don't have the experience of the dream state. We don't have the subject-object duality in that state. But still, it is my deep sleep. How do I know it's my deep sleep? When I'm in the deep sleep state, there's nobody saying, I'm deep sleeping, right? There's nobody there to be saying that. It's all an avyakta and unmanifest condition. But when you come back to the waking state, just like you talk about your dream, oh, I had this dream last night, you know? And of course, remember this too. In the dream state, you could have had a totally different body or no body. In a totally different situation, that it's not really existing in this waking state at all. But you say, I had a dream last night. Even though the body you were identified with was different, it could have even been a different gender, it could have been an animal for that matter, it could have been you and your little girl, it could be anybody, even somebody you don't know. But that is my dream. That was my situation. And so I identify with that situation that doesn't have much to do with the present, even though all the impressions could have come from the present, but that dream is not happening here and now in the waking state. But I still say that's my dream. That I have ownership of it belonging to me, the one who is now the waker. But in the same way, I have ownership of the deep sleep state. And it's not just the dream state. I have ownership of the deep sleep state. And how do I talk about the deep sleep state? Oh, when I had such a deep sleep, I didn't know anything. I slept so well last night. You can go on and on describing it. Well, did you know you were deep sleeping? Oh, no, I didn't even know. I wasn't even there. I was in totally unmanifest condition. Right? You can go on. You know, because you're talking about a state of experience, just like when you're talking about the dream state, you're talking about a state of experience. When you're talking about the waking state, you're talking about a state of experience. Your state of experience. I am the self of this world. I am the self of the dream world. I am the self of the deep sleep state, right? So these states of experience are all me. So now what he says, this pranava, this om, so in reference to the waking state, dream state, deep sleep state, all which come into being and go out of being, right? I am the self of all of those. So the om is the beginning, middle, and end of all, of everything. So I'm going to take this in two ways. For the sarvasya, for everything, this om, which the Upanishad has spent the whole last 12 verses unfolding, right? So this om is the adi, it's the beginning, it's the middle, and it's the end of all experience. When you say sarvasya, you can say of everything. You can say, what is everything? Well, it's everything that exists in the creation, in the time-space creation. It's the srishti, the creation itself. It's the stiti, the substance, the sustaining of the creation. And it's the laya, the dissolution of the creation. From the standpoint of the jiva, I can say, the om is the totality of my experience. It's, I am the self of the waking state. I am the self of the dream state. I am the self of the deep sleep state. And so, in fact, I am all. I am everything. Now, so he says, having known the pranava as all of this, one becomes that, one gains that. So I have to go a little bit further with this. To know myself as the waker is not enough. I have to know myself as both the waker and the waking state. Not just the waker. The Vishwa and the Virat. If I compare myself, the conscious being, who is the self of the waker and the waking state, to the dream, then it becomes very clear. It's easy for me to say that I am the self of the dream. Right? The dream comes from me, that's the srishti, is sustained by me, that's the sustenance, and laya resolves into me. I am the self, I am the one from whom the dream comes. I am the self of the dreamer, the one I'm identified with in the dream. I'm the self of all of the dream characters in the dream. I'm the self of the whole dream. And this self, this me that is the self of this dream, this me is also the self of the waking state. Now to really kind of understand this logic here, the dream state experience, when I'm in the dream state, we're clear on one thing. The one who's the waker, the me, the one who is now in the waking state, that me is the one in the dream state. Right? That's my dream.
Okay.
What we have to understand, though, is that in terms of my experience, the self who is present to the dream state is the self that is present to the waking state. That's clear. But we don't realize or tend to think about is that the experience of the dream state totally negates the experience of the waking state. In other words, when this dream world is being experienced, and it is a world, right, in which I'm included as the dream character, if I'm identified, that world of experience, when that is taking place, the waking state world of experience is not taking place. And so I then have to, my nature, who I actually am, has to be free of both states of experience in order to be the self of both of them. You understand? If one experience, here the waking, the dream state, if that experience negates the experience of the waking state, but I am the self of both, then neither one of these experiences can I be, because I'm the truth of both of them. Now, if we really understand what that means, is that myself is neither the waker or the waking state. It's neither the dream character or the dream state. Do you see why that would be? That's easy for us to understand in terms of the dream state, that the character that I'm identified is actually part and parcel of the dream state. It's not separate. It belongs to the dream state. It's like if right now, for instance, if I ask you to have an imagination, and I said, just imagine a beautiful meadow, and imagine all kinds of trees and wildlife, imagine the sun and the sun and some light clouds and maybe some gentle wind, and you with some of your friends are walking through this beautiful meadow, you know, and decide to sit down somewhere. So you have this beautiful imagination, right? Now, when you think about the imagination, the entire imagination, including all of the individuals within it, belong to the imagination. The individuals in the imagination are experiencing the imagination from within it, and on another level, the entire imagination is experienced. There's two experiences going on in reference to the imagination. The whole imagination is being experienced. What I mean by that, and we can see in the dream state also, the whole imagination is being experienced when I'm not identified with an individual within the imagination. When I'm identified with an individual within the imagination, then I'm experiencing the imagination from the sense perception of the individual within it. But if there's not an individual within it, it doesn't make any difference. Then I'm just the self of the whole. And the whole is known. So actually both of these are happening simultaneously. The one is Ishvara, where the whole projection of whatever it is known as one being, me. It's still me, but it's me, the whole. It's me as Ishvara. And from that perspective, the whole dream comes from me, is sustained by me, and resolves into me. Now, from the standpoint of those beings within the dream, they're experiencing the dream from the standpoint of their limited mind and sense organs. And you may be identified with one of them, right? When you're identified with one of them, then your knowledge is limited from within that dream because you're limited to your individual mind and sense organs. That's what this particular jiva is understanding, right? But in reality, you are both, if you're identified with the character in the dream, in reality, you are both the dream character and the dream. Because the whole thing is one unit. And that one unit comes from you, is sustained by you, and resolves back into you. And so actually, you are the Atma, the self, the limitless self. Limitless self means your being is not limited by the dream. See what I mean? It's limitless. Limitless in reference to what? Limitless in reference to all duality, really. So right now we'll say, me, this very me who I know so well, you know, who is the very me of the dreamer, because it's my dream, my being actually is not limited in any way by the dream. Because the dream comes from me, is sustained by me, resolves into me. I have no need of the dream one way or the other. Because I'm also the waker. The waker comes from me, is sustained by me, and resolves into me. Unless, I can't say that, it's harder to say that than it is to about the dreamer, because this Dehatma Buddhi, this identification with the body, mind, sense organs, is so much. When I'm standing so smugly as a waker looking at the dream, I have this kind of sarvajnatvam, this omniscience, this great grand knowledge in reference to the dream. But that knowledge of the reality of my being in reference to the dream doesn't that easily carry over to here. Because I don't see this creation as my projection. In the same way that the dream character within the dream doesn't see the dream world as his or her projection. I just happen to know that because I'm outside of the whole thing now and I can look at it and say, oh, this is what it is. But now I have to be able to understand that here in this waking state, the very being that is the self of the dreamer and the dream state, that very being is this me, is the self of the waker and the waking state. Once I understand that, once I recognize this, so there's some teaching that has to go on here to really gain clarity around this. But if I understand this, that my being, in fact, the me, this me, is free of all of this, right? Then all of this comes from me, is sustained by me, and resolves back into me in the same way as the dream. What am I going to say? My being cannot be limited by time and space and anything in it if I'm free of time and space. If I'm free of the time and space and quality of everything in the waking state and everything in the dream state and the two negate each other, my being isn't bound by that. And so my being is the self. Now, again, going to the dream state, you know, just through the analysis of your experience, that you, is very simple, me that I am, that you are the self, the truth of the dream state. That dream state enjoys you, the conscious being, the existence that the dream enjoys, the consciousness that the dream enjoys, that is you. And in fact, your being is what withstands the coming and going of the dream state. Right? Nothing happens to me when the dream goes away. When the dream is there, it depends totally on me for its being. When the dream goes away, I'm still there. Right? So I have no dependence there whatsoever. It's totally dependent upon me, but I'm not dependent upon it. You can understand the truth of this just here in this waking state in reference to your own imagination. A complex imagination like my meadow imagination. The imagination comes from you, and it's your imagination. So it's very clear that the imagination as it's there enjoys your being. You're the conscious being, the self of the imagination, and that means everything in it. And so, you know how you can have imagination and it kind of runs away with you? So you're identified with a character in the imagination and there's this whole world going on and then you wake up from it. It's like what we call a daydream, right? But that whole thing, no matter how lost you get in it by your identification with a character, when you wake up from it, you recognize this whole thing is only me. It has no independent being. That's what we say, it's what we call maya. Maya means that which is not, that is maya. It means here it is, but it has no being. That which is not, right? Mm-hmm. Here it is, but it has no being. I am its being. I am its truth. That's why we say mitya. Maya is mitya. So the dream, the imagination, clearly is mitya. It depends upon me. I am itself. But how is the waking state different? This physical, if you look at it, then this is so much of the analysis we continually have to do. In this waking state, this whole waking state that I'm experiencing now from the standpoint of an individual within it, everything enjoys consciousness. It is. Everything enjoys being. It is. Everything is known. The whole thing is known. Whatever is in my experience, it is known, and it is. That waking state goes away, and now the dream is and is known. Right? It's just no difference between the isness and the is-knownness. You just shift, get rid of this world, and bring in another one. I am the isness and the is-knownness. And now we're talking like third person, is and is known. It's really my amness, my being, which my self-evident being, the conscious being that I am, the whole universe of my experience enjoys. If I'm Ishvara, The whole creation enjoys that isness and knownness. Just like I'm the Ishwara, I'm the Lord of the dream. The whole dream enjoys the Sat Chit, conscious being, of me. If I'm Ishwara, in reference to this waking state, the whole universe enjoys the same me, the conscious being, you know, the conscious being, which is this very personal me. But in the waking state, I'm always identified with the body. I'm one of the characters in the dream. I'm here, the character here. So I have to be taught to recognize that actually what you're taking to be yourself, this body, mind, sense organs, that you're taking to be you, this me, is actually as objectified as everything else. This table is known through my five sense organs, so is this body. If I lose my eyes, I can't see the table, I can't see the body. This body is part of the warp and woof of the waking state. Just like the dream. Sense organs, dream sense organs, they're part of the fabric. They're also known, they're objectifiable. The thoughts in my mind, they're known, they're objectifiable, they come and go. They come into being and go out of being. So you say, the whole creation is just, on every level is one Srishti Stiti Laya. Comes in, Srishti, it comes into being. Stiti, it's there. Laya, it goes out. So we can talk about it as Ishwara, as the creation as being cyclical, the whole creation comes, becomes manifest, is sustained, and goes into resolution from beginningless time. Or you look at yourself from the standpoint of a jiva, you know, and all of your experiences are coming into being, sustained, going out of being. Being doesn't come into being, you know, and go out of being. Okay? So you are the constant, right? And this constant that is there as the very, what we call adhishtana, the reality. The adhishtana is the reality of whatever depends upon it. So like I can say, if I say, you know, I am the adhishtana of the dream state. It means without me, there's no dream state. I'm its being. If I use the rope snake analogy, the rope is the adhishtana of the snake. Without the adhishtana, there is no snake. So I'm the very self of all of this. So when I say, when we say the Om, and having the Mandukya Upanishad, having gone through really the three mantras, just of the letter, three letters Om, the O is actually A and U, it's a diphthong. So A, U, M. The A is the waking state, for when they give all the logic why A happens to be the waking state. U is the deep, is the dream state. The Makara is the deep sleep state. Now, when I say that Om is rising from silence, this is called the Amatra, where there's no limitation. If any sound, in fact, any sound is sustained by silence, the sound rises from the silence, is sustained by the silence, and sets in the silence. Actually, it's the silence of your consciousness. We think of sound as displacing silence. Right? That's how we normally think. Silence, sound, silence, sound. We'd have silence, Om, silence, Om, silence, Om. But the Om has to take place in silence, or you couldn't hear it. It's simple. It's so simple, right? The sound takes place in silence, or you couldn't hear it. It's the silence of your being, right? And so, in fact, the Om rises in silence, is sustained by silence, and sets in silence. The creation rises in the silence of awareness of the Sat-Chit, is sustained by that silence, that silent me, and resolves into that. So here, when we say Om, we have to recognize the adhishtana of the Om. So I am the adhishtana of the waking state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state. That's the whole, really, vision. When I really understand this vision, what the Omkara means, I have to say, then I am all of this. Right? The only way I cannot be all of this, if this is not mitya. If mitya means, if I say it's mitya, then this is all like a snake on a rope. If this is like the imagination in reference to me, the imagination has no being apart from me. The dream state has no being apart from me. The waking state has no being apart from me. I am its being. Easy to understand the dream. It takes more work to understand this waking state because you know what it's like? It's like imagine a dream and the dream character says, who am I and what am I doing here? The dream character. And the dream guru comes and has to sit that dream character down and explain this whole thing. And look at what the dream character has to realize. The dream character has to realize that I am the self of the whole dream. And I am free of the dream, and I am the self of the dream. And the dream character is going to say, how is that possible? And that's why it's not just going to be a few words. It means that there's a lot of teaching involved. Where you have to recognize step by step by step by step to being able to recognize the freedom of your own being amidst all of this experience. And every Upanishad has this as its what we call tatparya. Tatparya means that is what the Upanishad is doing. That's its purpose. The tatparya is the Mahavakya. That I am Brahman, that this Atma, this self that I am, this self is infinite. This self is the self of Ishwara, is the self of the Lord. There is only one self. Ishwara means the Lord, but by Lord, we keep the word Ishwara because in all of the different religions of the world, the Lord has different meanings, you know. So when we say Ishwara, it means the self that I am with this Maya is what manifests as this whole infinite creation, myself not going through any change whatsoever. So I need to differentiate and recognize the stability of my being amidst every experience. If I'm the self of the whole creation, at the same time being free because of this mitya relationship, kind of like the relationship of the dream to the self, and I recognize how I withstand any type of change as I go through the waking dream and even deep sleep state, I recognize the constancy, that constancy of my being, right? Then once that's recognized in my relationship, the relationship I have to this creation, which upon analysis has no being of its own. This creation, it's like the dream state or the deep sleep state. It has no being of its own, no independent being. For simple reasons, I'll give you two. One is that anything that you experience in this creation, if I ask you to tell me what it is, it's only a conglomerate. You can't find anything here. You can say, well, this like I use this lamp all the time. This is a lamp. No. This is a name for a conglomerate of things put together. This is a chair. No. It's a name. It's a nama for many things put together. And this is a rug. No. It is a bunch of threads in dye. And then that can be taken apart also. And so what we say is actually all of this, that you think there is something here, but when you analyze it, what we have here are names. They're just names, for in the end, what is actually here is just the Satchit. These are all different, a variety of names for Satchit, for conscious being. Because anything that we try to find here goes into an infinite regress of not being able to, every object that you find is just divisible into smaller objects. There's no end to it. At some point I have to take the object off, I have to take the form off of the object, and what is left is just a set chit. So we have nothing here but names upon names upon names. They say like this, names, namani, it goes, Namni namani. Names within names within names within names within names within names. There's no thing. And then the second thing is, so we can, right, we can spend hours, you know, showing example after example of that. But the other one is, everything that you call a thing comes into being and it goes out of being. Everything. There's nothing within duality that's not subject to change. That means that every single thing is bordered by non-existence. Right? Anything that comes into being wasn't there. The instance you say it came into being, it was born, then prior to being born, it was not. And then when it goes out of being, it's not. So it just has some little being in the middle. Right?
A temporary.
It's got being in the middle, but nothing on the sides. Nothing on the sides. Nothing can come from nothing. Right? Nothing comes from nothing because nothing's there for something to come from. And so what happens to this, with this understanding, is that you have to find actually what actually is there, what is actually the prior condition. And the prior condition can never be something that is subject to change. If the prior condition of what is actually there is subject to change, then it is dependent upon something else. Because otherwise we have non-existence, dependent upon non-existence, dependent upon non-existence, dependent on it's not possible. In the end, you have to get to just being itself. You can't get there if you're looking outward. You can only get there by recognizing what is. So if you think, so in the end, you have to be able to look like this. Okay, everything in this room is. That's the common denominator. Because why is it? Because I give isness to it. I experience everything. It is, it is, it is, it is. Common denominator, it's not like this has more isness than this. Or that this has more isness than this. Or of me. The whole thing is. And yet nothing here is. The whole thing is, but everything that I am giving that isness to must be dependent on it, but itself doesn't have it. It must be dependent on it because everything is. And say, let me give you another example. If something here, you know, like say for instance, we sometimes use this example. If I have like a clay pot and I drop it, and it smashes to smithereens. Okay? Now, the clay pot no longer is, right? It's gone. The smithereens are. The shards are. Nothing has happened to being, but what was there no longer is. You see what I mean? Shards are now. And that's true all of the time. If you go from waking state to dream state to deep sleep state, all of them are. If you go from one emotion to the next emotion to the next emotion, they've all come and gone, but nothing has happened to the isness. So that isness is like the silence that the Om comes out of. But that silence is me. That being is me. Everything, every single experience, even birth and death itself, is coming into my being and going out of my being. So you have to look at being you, this me, as the noun. I am the noun. I'm not some invisible adjective that I give to things. If I say like this table is, or this desk is means nothing. I'm only saying here's the table, that's all I'm saying. But we don't recognize the am, the isness. You can't see isness, but you can be amness. Right? The isness is the amness. There is no amness isness. There's only amness. That's why Swamiji will joke sometimes and say, you know, you have to say, okay, the painting am, and the you am, and the you know, the rug am. There is only am. Because I can't objectify being, you know. Or you can say I is and you is and it is, whatever you want. There's only one being experience, and that never goes. That is the reality. That's the Advaita. That's the non-dual reality. And so once you understand, so what they're saying here, now the Mandukya Upanishad has gone through so much work to divide the whole creation into waking, dream, and deep sleep state. Yeah. And then when, as you recognize that, I am really the self of these three states, and I am free of these three states. As I recognize this, then I'm the whole. I'm the self of them, the truth of all of them. And accepting these states, this world to be here, right? Accepting this mitya, this maya world to be here, then I am the whole. I am all of this. Because this isn't away from me. I wouldn't say I'm all of this from the standpoint of this body. From the standpoint of the body, I'm not the rug. But from the standpoint of me, I am all of this. All of this enjoys the being of all of this is my being. The being of the consciousness of all of this, the knownness of all of this is my being. There's a beautiful verse in the Chandogya that says, you know, just throw it like a piece of leather, roll up the whole creation, and you just toss it away and there you are. Mm-hmm. You know? Nothing happens to you. You notice it. Notice this. Moment to moment to moment, all these experiences are moving through. You're not moving. You are the one who is the presence of all of those experiences. You are not moving. The same waking, dream, deep sleep. Emotions are good to notice that. These emotions are so overwhelming. Emotions are like waves washing over you. You know? You're like you're drowning in the emotion, and then of course it moves on. Nothing has happened to you. The emotion is gone now. And do you ever remember having these feelings like, where did that go? Because when an emotion is there, it can be so overwhelming, you know. And then it's gone. It's not there anymore. You're still there. It's very amazing. Especially once you start realizing this, then you can just kind of enjoy the play of the whole thing, because you also start to recognize that during the play, you are there. Like, for instance, just to make this clear, because this can be true for the entirety of your experience. If you have you're in the waking state, you have an imagination, and I ask you to like, do the meadow imagination. You have the imagination, all the while it's very clear to you that it's imagination, right? All the while your own being is very clear to you, the whole thing is known. There's no ajnanam there, there's no ignorance. I'm the self of the imagination, nothing is happening to me, and the imagination is maya, it's amazing. I have clarity about the whole situation. But that's in reference to the imagination. But I can have that same clarity in reference to this. 5 more minutes, I'm going to tell you why you can have that. This is what people don't always understand this, but it's once you get it, it's irrefutable in a sense. What I'm actually knowing at any given moment is whatever thought modification I'm having. Right? And so if I use my sense organs, my eyes, to see the painting, or to look at this room, I'm now having a thought modification of the room which is known to me. You understand? I just think, just to make sure you get this, if my eyes are open and there's this room to see, my eyes are open, but I'm daydreaming, I'm not seeing the room, right? I'm only seeing what's going on in my mind. So in order for me to see this room, my eyes have to be open and my mind has to be using my eyes. And when that is the case, I will have a thought modification of the room. Okay? Clear? And so now in this thought modification that I'm having of the room, I don't recognize that I am the self of the whole thought modification, which is what I'm actually knowing. I'm not really knowing the room. I'm knowing the thought modification of the room. That has been given to me through my sense organs. It's been made of what we call a vritti, a thought modification, and that I illumine. Okay? this, that being so, this is how I gain knowledge and how I get around. Right, so I don't recognize that this thought modification, which I'm experiencing of the room, is really not any different than a thought modification I'm experiencing of the meadow imagination. Both are thought modifications. This thought modification is given to me through my sense organs. The meadow thought modification is given to me through my imagination. Both thought modifications, meadow and the room, are illumined by me. Both thought modifications equally enjoy my being. Both enjoy the knownness of my consciousness. It's not that this one is, in terms of thought modification, which is the actual experience I'm having, is any different than the meadow thought modification, in terms of it being what we call a vritti, a thought. However, in this thought modification of the room, if I say, you are the being of the whole room, you'll say, what do you mean? But if I say, in terms of the meadow, complex meadow with many people walking in it, if I say, you are the self of the whole meadow, you'll say yes. Okay. So this is a good exercise to do, because there's something wrong. And the wrong, there's something that's wrong there that stops me from seeing the pervasiveness of my being. Is this such a strong identification with the body, mind, sense organs, that my mind just translates all of the experience into subject-object, the subject that is here, that is experiencing the room, through my sense organs, and you are, 6 feet from me or whatever. So I'm immediately, everything is translated to me as the subject in this room that I'm experiencing. However, if you go to the actual level of your experience, which is the thought modification, it's very easy to see that your being is the self of your entire experience. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if you say the vritti, this is just a starter, okay? So take imaginal vrittis, memories, and perceptual vrittis. Vrittis means thought modification. And notice that you are the self of all of them. It doesn't matter what vritti it is. It could be a memory, it could be emotion. It could be the dream state, it could be the waking state, it could be anything. They're all exactly the same. Then your mind can go, yeah, but this waking state has more objective reality than the dream state. That's contestable, actually. From the standpoint of the self, both are mithya, both are maya. From the standpoint of me as a waker, that dream is subjective and comes from me. Right? So the dream is subjective. But from the standpoint of the Atma, the self, the subjective dream reality and the waking state reality are both maya. They have exactly the same level of reality. It's only when I look at that from the waking state that I say, well, this is... Swamiji will laugh and say, this is a longer joke. Yeah, than that subjective one. And it is a longer joke, and I'm the dream character within it. So it's not so easy for me to gain knowledge. It's as kind of a, what do you call, difficult as to gain, for me to understand that that this is my being, as it is for the dream character in the dream to understand that this is his or her being. Right? Because I'm so identified with the limited upadhi. But really, it's very, very helpful just to look at the actuality of your experience. And then you can say your next objection will be something like, yeah, but that's only on a subjective level. Vritti, vritti, still only subjective. That doesn't say anything about this physical world, the reality of this physical world, the Ishwa. Well, when we start to actually evaluate and analyze the reality of this physical world, what we find is that we can't find anything except the set, very set chit, which is the nature of the subject. But all of these words, all of these unfoldments, all of these Upanishads, they're all so necessary. All of these different prakriyas, all these different teaching methodologies are flooding you in a way, hopefully flooding you with the recognition of your being amidst all of this. It's like holding up a mirror in many, many different ways to make you recognize yourself. And once that's understood, then you become that. Having understood that, you become that. No. That's the truth. Having understood that, then you become that. No. You always have been that. So having understood it, once you understand it, you become what you already are. That's the idea. Okay. So why don't we stop there? Take a minute. Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.
When you're having an experience, you have to shift to see that experience as a thought modification. There's kind of a process happening there.
I would say when I'm doing that little unfoldment that I did, it's something for you to recognize. You recognize the truth of it. And if you can see the truth of it in reference to a vritti, like say you practice, you think of your imagination, and then you recognize, yeah, I actually pervade the entire imagination. Then you bring in a perceptual vritti, like with your eyes. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. Now can you see that your being is the self of that whole vritti in the same way that your being mm-hmm. is the self of the imagination? Because you don't have any of this dehatma buddhi, this conviction of yourself as the body, where you're so situated in this that you're immediately drawn into the duality of the creation that you find yourself in, which is normal, right?
Yeah.
But if you can go back and forth from this perception to like an imagination and recognize your pervasiveness and all, not just pervasiveness, it's that the imagination is not away from you. It's not that the self becomes pervasive and then goes but not pervasive. It's that the imagination takes place in you. Right? There's no place in the imagination that's away from your being. And that, you're very free to recognize that because there's no this conviction of being the body. Whereas now here, when I'm doing this is born of my sense perception. Right, and my sense organs are located in this body, and so here's this physical body where my sense of touch is pervading the body, right? And so this is calling my attention, sucking up all of the meanness.
Yeah.
Right? But actually your physical body is known to you through your sense organs. Right? And your sense organs are also known by the mind. And they're also, all of this information is all included in the vritti. and your being lights up the whole thing. Yeah. Your being lights up the thoughts, the thought itself, which includes the sense organs, which includes the body, which includes whatever is external to the body. So you have to kind of just relax. Yeah. And just let this conviction, don't worry about this body. Just let it be part, let the body and all of the internal sensations and everything that's going on belong to the perception equally. And then just notice, where are you not? The whole thing is taking place in your being. Like, sometimes I use this one, like, if I say right now from my perspective, I am, 12 feet from the wall, or 10 feet from the wall, okay? What's 10 feet from the wall? Well, my body is 10 feet from the wall, that's right. But how far is the wall from my consciousness? It's not 10 feet, right? Because the wall's in my consciousness. And everything intervening is in my consciousness. There's nothing, in fact, in this experience that's not in my consciousness. But I only think of, you know, distance and dimension from the standpoint of this body as being an object within the room. But from the standpoint of just Satchit, conscious being, there is no distance at all. So I have to play with that a little bit until I start to recognize and can differentiate me, you know, as being not contained just to this body. The me, my own being, it's not contained. And now the thing is, you have to play with that for a while, because you have to remember that me, your own self, is consciousness. That means it's self-evident. The self-shining nature of me, it doesn't need your mind, doesn't need the sense organs. It's because of yourself that the mind and the sense organs are illumined, right? So you yourself don't require the mind and the sense organs to be. And so this self-evident me that I am is actually not contained by anything. But the mind enjoys it. And the sense organs enjoy it. And from Ishwar's standpoint, the whole creation enjoys it. That's why you can have a dream. And when you're having a dream, you're the Ishwar of the dream. But just to make sure you know what I mean by that, if you have a dream, sometimes you're not identified with a character in the dream. Then what? You're the whole dream. The whole dream is your canvas. The whole dream is known to you. Then you become identified with a dream. You pop into the dream as though you're identified with the dream, and then you're experiencing the dream from within it. But when you're not identified with a person or, you know, a being, a creature in the dream, then you're just the whole. And that's a beautiful thing to understand, because that's fine with you. It's absolutely fine with you not to have a body. You don't think, oh, I don't have a body. This is who you are now. You're Ishwara, in terms of the dream. For the Jivanmukta, the one who has been really liberated, means has self-knowledge. When this body drops, that particular jivatvam is no longer there. So who's left? Well, Ishwara. I'm left, the me, and who am I? Really, I am the whole. Now, as the whole, I can be also identified with a given individual within that. But when that individual is liberated and the karmas that have caused it to go through the life, you know, when that, the prarabdha karma, when that is over, then that particular jivatvam limitation is no longer there. Because even for a person who has knowledge, even while you're alive, it's not there. Because you're you. There's no longer an ahankara, an I notion that's totally identified with this. Because that requires ignorance, self-ignorance. And when that ignorance is not there, then your being is, you are the constant in all of your experience. And then when the body drops, the prarabdha is over, then you still are that constant. There's no identification with the limited upadhi. And so then you are just the Ishwara that you have been all along, but without the identification of a limited upadhi. That's just an aside for people who have been here a long time. Putting a few things, tying a few things together.
You know, what was your point in saying that isness and isknownness are kind of the same? What's the exact point? Yeah.
The exact point is that when we say that the nature of yourself is conscious being, say we use a word like that. Another word we use is this, that you, the self that you are, is self-evident. We use that, and that's what the siddha, the self is self-evident, means it doesn't require pramana, means of knowledge, for it to be known, it's self-evident. For the amnes, this amnes to be self-evident means it is consciousness. It's not inert, it's consciousness. That's why it's self-shining. Okay. Now, that self-shining, another word we can use for that self-evident nature is that it is known without a pramana. There's no means of knowledge. It is just known because it's self-evident, because existence is consciousness. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, when we look at our experience of anything and everything, every level of our experience is known. There's no knower. I mean, we think there's a knower, but that's illusory in this sense. I can just now, if I say, okay, this room, you know, this room is known. Right? And how is it known? It's known by my sense organs. Right? The perception of this room is known by my sense organs. So the sense organs themselves are known, though. The thought that is generated by the sense organs, that thought, which is the vritti of this room, that is also known. Right? The sense organs are an instrument, true, through which there is a vritti which is known. Any vritti, any thought modification is known. The self is known, because self-evident. So the self-evident nature of me is the self-evident nature of all things known. There is no knower known. There's only known. We want to find a knower, but you're making up a knower because something is known. Like, say, if I say, do you understand? It's like this wall is known. Why is it known? Oh, because of my eyes. So my eyes become the knower of the wall, okay? But the eyes are just an instrument for giving me a thought modification, right, of the wall, and that thought modification is known. Any thought modification, by the very fact of its being there, is known. There's nobody knowing it. It is known. But why is it known? What allows it to be known is self-evident conscious being. That's what allows it to be known. The knownness is the same from the very being of myself all the way out. It is known, it is known, it is known, it is known, it is known. It resolves, the knownness resolves in the self-evident nature of conscious being.
You make it sound like it's free of time and free of objectivity, that it just, it's part of the presence of...
Every experience that I have is known. If I take away the experience, what is left is known. That's what I mean by swatha siddha, the self-evident nature of me, right? Through the mind and sense organs, because the mind and sense organs are sattva, like the rug's not having a knownness of anything. let me explain that a little differently. The knownness that everything, any and everything enjoys is my own swarupa. Is my own nature. And everything comes in and out of that knownness. When it's there, you need a mind. From the standpoint, Ishwara doesn't need a mind. Right. Because of the sattva, that because of the nature of the whole Maya Upadi. But this body, and there's in within the creation, not every but everything has a sukshma sharira that has the sattva. So from its own standpoint, it's not always experiencing is known from its own standpoint. But there is only one is known. There's only one conscious being, right? But if I'm going to get lose you all here, but I'll just do this anyway, just real quick.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah, but see, there's one. There's only one is known, which is the Adhishtana, which is really the rope snake Adhishtana, the truth of everything. But if I hold a mirror up to the sun and a rock up to the sun, these two materials, both mitya, both maya, say, one can reflect the sun and one can't. But neither one of them is the satchit, right? But one has the quality of being able to reflect and the other doesn't. And so the one that can reflect, it can say, I am the conscious being. The mirror can say, I am the sun, right? And so every here in this room, so there's all of us in the plants. We have subtle bodies, which are different than, say, the rug and the chair, you know, and the lamp. They don't have subtle bodies. So from their own standpoint, they're not saying, I'm the lamp and I'm the chair. Because they don't have a subtle body. They don't have that sattva. They don't have a mind and sense organs. But they are as much the satchit as everything else. But from their own standpoint, they can't take ownership. Where my mind, even though it's kind of like the mirror, right? And the mirror has that reflective quality, so it can say, I am the sun. You know? I am the sun, and if you have a mirror, you are also a sun. Right? But really, there's only one sun. So like that, there's only one self, which is the conscious being, the knownness, the being of everything. Humans especially, animals don't seem to be so concerned about this, and plants aren't concerned. But animals are humans are concerned about this because they are self-reflective and they say, I am a conscious being, identifying the mind, take the mind and body taking ownership over the me. And so when the mind takes ownership over me, then the mind has to say, and sometimes I'm really miserable, and sometimes I'm happy. I want to be happy all of the time. I don't want to have this anxiety and this angst and this depression and this hurt. I want to just be happy, you know? And not only that, I'm also going to die because this mind and sense organs are located in this body and this body is going to die. So therefore, I'm going to die. And so now here I have become this limited being. From the standpoint of who? Not from the standpoint of me, the who I actually am. For me, I'm fine. But this poor mind is suffering. I become like a limited person who's subject to birth and death and misery and having to make my way and trying to make the world work for me somehow so that I can be happy and can relax and all of this samsara. That's what they call samsara. You know, the samsara is that which is continually moving. It never stops, you know. And that includes the body, mind, sense organs. Everything is in perpetual motion, and so nobody can catch. You can catch little glimpses of feeling all is well with me, but things keep moving. Yeah. So, but actually, everything's fine. Everything is fine. But the avidya, the ajnanam that the mind is suffering from has created, you know, and it's beginningless. It's not like we made a mistake or something. This is just a natural course of events of the what would be natural for the creation, for the, you know, limited being, in, the limited beings within the creation are going to enjoy, you know, suffer from ignorance until it's removed.
So you were saying, how far can you be away from time and space? Is the answer... Mm. How much you are identified and how much you are not.
You're always is free of time and space, and you're the self of time and space.
But if I'm identified with something, I'm not really... I'm identified, I'm somebody, let's say.
Well, yeah, but you have to remember...
Then I'm nailed to time and space, and I'm not free of it.
It depends on what you mean by identified. Like, if you know yourself, mm-hmm. in a real way, I mean, not just like a partial... If you really understand, if you really know yourself... then you are always free of time and space, being in the midst of time and space. Mm-hmm. Because this body is bound by time and space, the mind is bound by time and space, sense organs, everything. All experience is bound within time and space, but you're the self of that, and you're self-evident. Mm-hmm. And for you, there is no time and space. Mm-hmm. And that is as self-evident as the Maya that's taking place by the Maya, I mean by the experience that you're having. Both are there. The Ishwara, this Ishwara, the whole Maya that we find ourselves in is body, mind, sense organs, all of this, that is going on, but it's not away from me. Mm-hmm. I am the changeless, timeless self in which all this is taking place. So there's a viveka. Remember that yourself is self-evident. It's not like you need the mind to keep flashing on you to, oh, yes, there I am, there I am, there I am. Keep remembering of. What a nightmare that would be. But that's not what it is. Because you're the self is self-evident. That means with or without the creation, you are. And so once that's been discerned, then I always am, my self-experience, me is always here, me, never changing in any way, and all of this other stuff's going on too. The thoughts in the mind, the perception, the creation, you know, but this all becomes Ishwara. And even Ishwara means it's all Ishwara. All of this is Ishwara. Now, the one thing that I think is helpful to understand, say you're starting to gain some clarity and knowledge. One thing you can recognize, even going back in time before you had any knowledge, self-knowledge, I mean, there are many times for you, though you might not say it, that everything is just Ishwara. Because there's no ahankara. The ahankara that I know, after all, it's just a thought. Right? There are times when there's no ahankara being manifest. The ajnanam is still there, the ahankara, that I notion is still there, alive and well, but it's not always manifest. Like sometimes, for instance, when you're taking a walk in nature, or a walk on the ocean, or listening to beautiful music, or petting your cat, whatever. There are so many times when the jiva's not there, this jivatvam. It's just, it's not that it's not there, because if they're still ignoring, it's just not in operation at the moment. You know, so those are all the beautiful times. When the ajnanam is gone, though, then that's just always how it is. Mm-hmm. And becomes more and more that way, especially as it's all right for the world to be as it is, and it's all right for your mind to be as it is, and it's, there's no one that needs to make it different. And that's why some of the meditations I'm focusing on right now lately, over the last couple months or so, are these relaxation exercises, because if you can learn that, then the quality of the mind becomes very different. If you learn how to be present to whatever the affect is, whatever the thought is, whatever the problem is, if you don't push it away and just relax, mm-hmm. you just relax it. It takes on. You're not asking it to change. You're not mm-hmm. asking it to go away. You can even have inner dialogue with it. Whatever needs to be done. There's many different things that we can do for some of these more treacherous problems that we. But that ability to just relax, and as you relax, it's almost like the sunrise. as you relax, your own presence becomes predominant. Mm-hmm. Your being becomes predominant. And then whatever you're thinking about becomes mithya. Mm-hmm. To you. Right, you know, instead of this heavy duty engagement.
It seems like there's this empathetic kind of inclusion.
Yeah.
And so the antagonism kind of ceases.
It goes away.
Yeah.
It just goes away. And then what's good about it is that then you can actually be objective. It's not that you are kind of erasing the reality of your situation. It's just that this angst and the terrible emotional states we can get involved in. When you get in those kind of states, all you have to do is if you have this presence of mind through some practice, is you just say, wait a minute, you just relax. Let it be there. Don't push it away. You just relax. And if it's something that is hurting you, you know, like these long-term agonies that we have that have been going on for years, so whatever they are, you know, you can accommodate them. Mm-hmm. Like there are things in the world and in our past that have happened to us that, you know, you can say all kinds of things like, and that was really a terrible thing to have happened. That was a very, very hurtful thing to have happened. And within samsara, within, it was. Like say you were betrayed or so many, there's some things that happen in life that are not fun, you know, and you don't have to say, oh, that's okay. You can say, no, that was really hard. I understand. I'm sorry that happened. But all the while just letting the mind relax and then it feels okay. You know that it was hard, especially the parts, you know, the unconscious parts that are still suffering. You know that it was hard. You're not trying to pretend that it wasn't hard. You're not trying to pretend that you weren't really badly hurt or devastated or all of the different things that we've gone through in life. And, but you say, I know that was really hard if it's bothering you, you know.
But you shouldn't hold on to these things.
No, but you, as you say it, you just relax.
Yeah, you should, you know, sense of letting go.
Yeah, if the sense of letting go is just relaxing and letting it be, you know.
But it's not and a spiritual bypass.
No, it's not a spiritual bypass at all. And you can also, because you're not trying to make it not be.
Yeah.
In fact, you're making complete. It's not. Yeah, you're making room.
It's not a process of disassociation.
No, it isn't. Yeah. It's a process of really
inclusion
and relaxation, and then also. You know, your mind learns how to, as you relax, because you become dominant, predominant, your being becomes predominant, your mind can just, you know, almost like dive into yourself. They use this analogy in the Taittiriya Upanishad of the mind, you know, diving into your being and taking a bath. You know, just diving deeply into your being, taking a bath. It's really sweet. But these are all metaphors and analogies for the tremendous freedom of just relaxing into your own presence without needing at all to push anything away or to feel like things that were hurtful, you shouldn't be hurt, they were hurtful.
Right.
But you know what? As you relax, they lose their edge, and you haven't denied them. These are all just—it's all psychology. I mean, once we're—it's psychology, but it's a psychology based upon our knowledge.
Right.
Right.
Well, there's a kind of ontology involved.
Yeah.
You know, like
there's an understanding
the
instability involved.
Instability is always going to be unstable because it's mithya, but that's always in a stable self.
And that stable self, that you, is so benign.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your own nature. That's why, you know, when we do these meditations, sometimes I'll say something like, just notice who you are, what you are like. because your being is so beautiful, it can't be improved upon. But you have to get to know, you have to recognize it. And then it's kind of a surprise. Oh, that's really true.